From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Lawmakers on both sides of the political fence are having second thoughts about Bush's bailout plan. We'll take a look at how the McCain campaign is clamping down on media access to Veep candidate Sarah Palin. Plus, Democratic VP candidate Joe Biden criticizes his own ticket's campaign ads. Here to break all of this down for us is Mary Frances Berry. She is a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. And Robert Trainum. He is the D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast cable network CNN. Welcome, folks.
Well,
hey, Tony.
Hello there.
I think we have a few things to talk about today. Let me set the table for you this way. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke are pushing for the quick passage of a $700 billion federal bailout.
If the credit markets are not functioning, that jobs will be lost, the unemployment rate will rise, more houses will be foreclosed upon, GDP will contract, that the economy will just not be able to recover in a normal, healthy way, no matter what other policies are taken.
That was Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke. Now, Paulson and Bernanke are running into resistance, however. Even some GOP lawmakers are now against the plan.
This massive bailout is not a solution. It is a financial socialism, and it's un-American.
How do you rationalize or justify bailing out banks and so forth that caused or the root cause of a lot of this problem?
That was Republican Senator Jim Bunning and Republican Senator Richard Shelby. So here's the question. Who wants to go first, Mary or Robert?
Ladies first.
All right. Why are lawmakers on both sides of the political spectrum resistant to this idea of the Wall Street bailout?
First of all, the polls indicate that ordinary Americans in flyover country and on Main Street are upset about it because many of them don't understand why, if people's mortgages were foreclosed and they had to declare bankruptcy and they're out of their houses, that these people seem to be benefiting. When they see the huge salaries and the stock options and all the rest of it, they get upset. So they're saying things on talk radio and everywhere else. And so the lawmakers hear this, and there's an election in November, and many of them are up for reelection. The second thing is that after having blown very hard against this and made all kinds of rhetorical statements in the Congress, in the end, they will vote for something. Simply because, one, most of them don't really understand the intricacies of what's going on anyway, and they're afraid that something worse will happen. Even if they don't understand it, anything better will happen, so that in the end, something will pass after everything is said and done.
Are you surprised,
Tony, if
Robert,
I could take this, Tony, if I could take this one step further, for those out there who do understand this, what they can't understand is why would Main Street bail out Wall Street? Why are we rewarding bad behavior? I mean, poll after poll after poll, if you take a look at some of the blogs and some of the opinion emails and so forth that I'm receiving and so forth, people get this. They understand that there are a lot of people, a lot of bad actors out there on Wall Street who did bad things. And thus in the process, why should the farmers and the teachers and the police officers and the average taxpayer out there bail these individuals out? And then thus in the process, even go one step further and give these individuals golden parachutes. And even if I can go even one step further, a lot of folks out there are saying, well, wait a minute, I pay my taxes. I paid my mortgage on time. I paid my credit cards on time. Why in the world did these people, which was no fault of their own, receive these bad loans or receive loans, rather, with bad credit when they shouldn't receive them in the first place? So a lot of people out there do understand this, and what they do understand, they don't like. And that's the main reason why a lot of lawmakers out there, both the Republican and Democrats alike, are saying, first and foremost, why are we rewarding bad behavior? And even more importantly, why should we give $700 billion to one individual, that being Hank Paulson, who's the current Secretary of Treasury, who only has about 4 months left on his job?
So this doesn't surprise you.
Tony, to take it even further, Hank Paulson has several times predicted that if step one, two, three, four that he was taking occurred, the whole crisis would be solved, and then it wasn't. So people don't really believe what he's saying either. I'm just saying that even after all of this is true, and I agree with everything that Robert said on this for a change, that in the end, something will pass simply because all of that sky is falling language that you started with about unemployment will go up and the rivers will run and whatever will happen. The fear in the Congress will be that if we don't do anything, then something will happen. The other thing to keep in mind is
Let me jump in to say this, because I have a question whether or not – I want to direct it to you, Robert. You're not surprised at all then, obviously, that the Republican lawmakers on the Hill are blowing back against their own party's plan for the bailout, and they're doing this because they don't have faith in the plan, or they're doing it because they're trying to cover their own political backs?
Well, it's a combination of the things that you just mentioned, but if I can go one step further, philosophically, they just don't believe in this plan. This goes against every single free market conservative, or even Democrat for that matter, where it's like, why in the world are we using publicly funded taxpayer dollars to bail out private companies? We just don't do that in this country. And when we do that, it's usually with the loan. We did it in the 1980s with Chrysler. We did it to a certain degree after 2001 with the airline industry. But again, those were loans. And thus, in the process, we must remember that Chrysler paid back their loan 18 months early with interest.
But Bernanke and Paulson are both saying that you're right, that this isn't the best way to do it, but that the alternative is even worse, and that the alternative is still going to fall on the backs of the taxpayers.
Well, if I may say, that in fact what is happening is that the lending institutions are saying that they're holding us hostage in a sense. They're saying that with all of these bad mortgages and derivatives on our books, unless we can get rid of them, then credit is going to stay frozen and there won't be any credit. So the only way to do it is to get rid of them, have the government take these assets and then price them and do something with them, and then we can go on with our business and it will free up credit and we can go on. But Robert is quite right again that one way to do this is simply to make a loan to the businesses who want to take it, the lenders who want to take it, and have them pay the taxpayers back with interest, which has been done in other cases and has been done in other countries.
Let me ask both of you this. Part of the blowback on the bailout coming from both Republicans and Democrats has to do with these 5 points, and I'd like to get your response to them. The first is that they think that the government needs to take an equity stake in some of the companies that it is helping. The bankruptcy laws should be changed so that judges can modify the mortgages of filers' primary residences. They want to curb executive compensation on the companies participating in the bailout. They want oversight over Treasury, and they want to require the government to promote sustainable home ownership through loan modifications, which is what you just were referring to. These 5 points, are they deal breakers, do you think, Robert?
I don't think they're deal breakers. I think they're very realistic expectations given the fact that we're in this mess. Look, Tony, this is a Band-Aid on a skull fracture. There are no good options out of this. The fact of the matter is that you have some of the leading academic folks as well as the financial individuals that are saying that if you do not do something, Congress, if you do not do something, the president, our financial system will collapse to the extent of 1933 during the Great Depression. So the unfortunate thing about this is, and this is why Congress is so upset, is that they're literally backed into a corner where they have to act, but all of their options are no good options.
Now, one of the things that's happening, which is making this much more difficult for Congress to act upon, is the fact that we have an election for the presidency coming up in just a matter of weeks. Both presidential nominees, Barack Obama and John McCain, have weighed in on this plan. Here's a clip from both of them.
It is wholly unreasonable to expect that American taxpayers would or should hand this administration or any administration a $700 billion blank check with absolutely no oversight or conditions, when a lack of oversight in Washington and on Wall Street is exactly what got us into this mess.
We won't solve a problem caused by poor oversight with a plan that has no oversight. Never before in the history of our nation has so much power and money been concentrated in the hands of one person, and there must be protections and oversight in place.
Mary, they sound like they agree, but do they really?
They agree that there should be a bailout simply because of what is at stake and because both campaigns have people in them who come from these lending institutions that did the dirty deeds. And in fact, they give these lending institutions give huge campaign contributions to both campaigns. And also, they don't want to be wrong about what might happen, so that they both support a bailout with the conditions. The problem is that there will getting these conditions done in a week, which is what they keep talking about, that they're going to pass a bill in a week or a few days and go home, that Robert said were good conditions, and I agree, it isn't likely to happen, and you can't figure out how to do it. The oversight part, yes. There will be some kind of oversight. But the campaigns sound like they're on the same page pretty much, with a few changes here and there, because both of them do not want to stand in the way of something that will solve the crisis, if that's possible to do.
Well, it's interesting, too, isn't it, Robert, that both of the candidates, including McCain, are pointing the fingers at the Republicans?
Well, you know, they are. And also, what's also fascinating about this whole entire conversation, Tony, is that you have three sitting United States senators that are running for national office. Obviously, Joe Biden in that mix as well. So what's even going to be even more fascinating about this whole entire conversation is whether or not they will fly back to Washington to either A, vote for this bill, or B, not to vote for it, or C, to not vote at all. And so they're in a very precarious position in of themselves. But having said all of that, they most likely will vote for it. They will close their eyes and hold their noses and say, you know, this is the best, literally putting a lipstick on a pig, the best option that they could do given the circumstance.
This is one that Barack Obama cannot afford to vote president on. Let me just say, by the way, that a poll from ABC and the Washington Post shows that Obama has gotten a bump, about a 9-point bump, as a result of the economic crisis. What we're going to do, Robert and Mary, we're going to continue the conversation about that and some other things that are taking place on the campaign trail. But first, we have to take a break. We'll be right back. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. We're back now with Robert Trainum, the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Cable Network, CN8, and Mary Frances Berry, a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. Quite a good discussion we had going before the break. Let's pick it up with this, though. Warren Buffett now has joined the economic fray, dumping, maybe I shouldn't use that word, let's just say investing.
Injecting.
Injecting $5 billion into Goldman Sachs. What does this do to the conversation? Mary, you first.
Well, I think it shows that some of these companies, Goldman Sachs, gold-plated Goldman Sachs, there are companies that have assets that, and people going forward where investors think they can make a profit, and that's what Buffett is saying. It also is like the stockholders in AIG who are now suing and saying they could have gotten a better deal not from the government but waiting for somebody to buy the company since it had pieces, although Buffett does say that he expects there to be a bailout and that he wants one. He didn't say what the contours were. But if these companies were to be there and not have the bailout, some of the pieces of them that are worth something, somebody would take. I mean, that basically is where we are.
Well, do you think it gives you would it give the stock market, Wall Street, Robert, a sense of security to have Warren Buffett in the mix?
When Warren Buffett speaks, the world financial community listens. And not only do they listen, they typically follow his lead. And so with Mr. Buffett investing $5 billion of Berkshire Hathaway stock into Goldman Sachs, he's basically telling the world community two things. One, I have faith in our financial system. Thus, in the process, I'm doing $5 billion or injecting $5 billion into the system. But also, two, and just as importantly, you need to follow my lead. You need to continue to do what you do, which is to listen to what I say because I think I know what I'm talking about. And what's also very interesting about this, Tony, and Mary obviously knows this as well, is that people do follow Warren Buffett's lead. But the caveat being is that when Warren Buffett made his comments this morning saying that he would invest $5 billion of Berkshire Hathaway stock, he said this saying that I'm only doing this knowing that the Congress is going to vote for the $700 billion bailout. So it was a little bit of a chicken and egg type of game that he's playing, which is somewhat psychological. And he's also talking not only to the financial world community, but he's also talking to the 535 members of Congress as well.
Absolutely. Let's move on to another topic that we have in our time that's left. Two of them, as a matter of fact. The first, both of the vice presidential candidates, one of them, Sarah Palin, being protected by the campaign. Yesterday, she met with a couple of foreign leaders in an effort to bolster her foreign policy credentials. Meetings got off to a little bit of a bumpy start because news organizations were at first not allowed in, and then they threatened to boycott, and then they were allowed in. And at the same time, on the other side of the aisle, you have Joe Biden making some gaffes, some would say, criticizing his own party's campaign ads. What's going on here, Mary?
I think that at this point, the vice presidential candidates only count when it comes to the debates, any news about them. Palin obviously wanted to be able to say that she's met this one and that one and the other one. And the fact that they don't let the news organizations follow her or question her, she has nothing to lose. The McCain campaign has nothing to lose by doing that. They probably think they're better off not letting her be questioned than letting her be questioned. It's all going to come down for the VP candidates to the debates. Biden, everybody knows that Biden says whatever comes into his head a lot of the times. And sometimes it is what is called a blooper or a gaffe. I think overall he's been beneficial to the campaign out where he's been campaigning. He's a benign choice. And with him, too, it'll come down to if he makes a blooper or a gaffe like that during the debates, then it may be somewhat of a game changer. But otherwise, he's fine.
Yeah, I saw him on TV in Cincinnati today, and it really looked to me like he was sticking to the script and reading from that teleprompter very carefully. Question for you, Robert, is this. GOP says that they are more the visits of Sarah Palin with these foreign leaders. They're more designed to introduce her to folks like Henry Kissinger, who she can call on later to consult with, knowing that you can't cram foreign policy experience into a couple of weeks before an election. Do you buy that line of reasoning?
Somewhat. Look, I remember, you know, 6 months ago when Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were in the primary duking it out, the Clinton campaign was complaining that Senator Obama was not making himself available to the press. Excuse me. The only thing that he was doing was reading from the teleprompter in front of, you know, tens of thousands of people. This is a merry-go-round that all campaigns go through. And the first thing that you want to do is do no harm. And so what you try to do is you try to limit all the incidences where the press can ask your candidate, you know, these jarring questions. I've been through, what, six presidential campaigns now, and this is a classic example. Now, juxtapose that to the Democratic side. Senator Biden is a refreshing, very approachable individual. The Obama campaign knew that when they picked him that he was someone that was going to speak his mind and that was not going to hold his tongue. Now, having said that, there's enormous, enormous refreshingness with that, as I mentioned before, but enormous risk as well as that's what we're seeing throughout the last couple of days.
All right, let me give you both the 1 minute warning because we're about to get out of here, but
okay.
We want to talk about the debates on Friday night. What does Barack Obama need to do, Mary? And leave time for Robert to answer his question about
Barack Obama with this economic crisis should be gaining and gaining on McCain and leading him and running away from him in the polls and everywhere else. And all he needs to do during the debate is to hold his own, be sensible, take his time. He doesn't need to do anything startling at all because he's ahead.
What does John McCain need to do, Robert Trainum?
He needs to raise expectations that he, in fact, is ready to lead on day one. He also needs to paint Senator Obama as someone that is an incredibly gifted individual but is unable to deal with the crisis at hand.
I appreciate it. Mary and Robert, thank you both. Good show.
Thank you.
That was
thank
Mary Frances Berry. She spoke with us from Morris Creative Studios in Eastham, Massachusetts. And Robert Trainum, he is the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Cable Network CN8. He joined us from Audio Post in Philadelphia. From Oprah's influence in the Middle East to a gas shortage that has crippled parts of the American Southeast, the topics on our blog, News and Views, have hit on an array of events this week. Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes. He joins me now with an update. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tony.
So, a recent New York Times article detailed Oprah Winfrey's growing influence, I should say, in Saudi Arabia, of all places. What's that about?
Well, yeah, the Oprah Show first broadcast in Saudi Arabia in November 2004, and it became an instant hit with women 25 and younger in that country, according to the Times. Now, the article reads, "In a country where the sexes are separated, Miss Winfrey provides many young women with new ways of thinking without striking them or Saudi Arabia's ruling authorities as subversive." So, you know, Oprah, love her or hate her, is always a flashpoint for conversation. And on our blog, Jessica writes, "It's amazing to see a down-to-earth black woman from Mississippi appeal to so many different people here in the U.S. and in other countries." Another reader named Zakita Jones says, "I am awed at how fast different forms of globalization are taking off and reaching other countries." But Candace James writes, "Oprah works my last nerve. Saudi Arabia can have her."
Speaking of women's issues, another hot topic on our blog this week, women who are choosing to be single mothers. What's been the response?
Yeah, we linked to an article by blogger Kira Kraft. She wrote, "I don't need a man to have a baby. I don't need to find the one to procreate." So we asked, for women who aren't in a relationship but do want children, is going it alone, you know, is that a viable option? And one reader wrote, "Certainly. I want to be a parent, don't want to be a wife. I have the financial means, the emotional stability, so why not?" Another reader using the alias Whole9 says, "I don't believe that simply wanting a child is a sufficient reason to have one." And T. Dawn says, "If a woman decides to become a single parent, I hope she also considers that a child will want a family. Being a parent is awesome. Deciding to be a single parent with no other type of partner is selfish."
On another topic, the country's financial meltdown has moved attention away from the gas shortage, which hit parts of the Southeast this week. But our online community has been affected by it, right?
Yeah, parts of Atlanta, Georgia, and parts of Florida and areas around Nashville have been really hardest hit. And the shortage is due to supply problems after Hurricane Ike. So a reader named Dennis wrote in our blog, "I literally drove past 28 different gas stations before finding one that still had gas for sale." And a reader in Asheville, North Carolina says that cars were stretching half miles in two different directions out of that gas station. And some perspective from another reader in Kansas City, he says, "We have plenty of gas and no lines. Looks like the folks in the Southeast are getting jerked around since we also get our gas from those Houston refineries, which were hit by Ike."
Wow. Well, in the time we have left, what else is on the blog that people are talking about?
Well, Katie Couric is set to interview Sarah Palin, so we're taking folks' questions. We want to know what they think Katie Couric should ask. We've got video interviews with singer Eric Benet and Glenn Turman, who won an Emmy over the weekend.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, we're going to revisit that video. And we have more video interviews coming up with the cast of Spike Lee's Miracle at St. Anna.
Oh, sounds like some good stuff.
Yeah.
All right, Jeffrey Bennett, thank you very much. Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, joining me here in our studios at NPR West. And now on to our bloggers roundtable. Here are some of the stories heating up the internet. Could racial prejudice decide the presidential election? A new poll says it could. Plus, O.J. Simpson's robbery trial is underway in Las Vegas, but is anybody really paying any attention? And a new study ties attitudes about gender roles to income. With us to talk about all of these things, freelance journalist Danielle Belton. She runs the blogs Black Snob and the Secret Council of American Negroes. Sean Williams, who publishes the blog Dallas South. And to join us later, hopefully, will be a Harvard Law student, Claudio Simpkins. He is the contributor to the blog Hip Hop Republican. Hello, everybody. How are you?
I'm
hey,
good,
how's
thanks.
It going? Doing well, thanks.
Great. Let's talk about this racism in the White House poll. 40% of all white Americans hold at least a partly negative view of African Americans, many calling them lazy, violent, or responsible for their own troubles. Now, that's according to a recent joint Associated Press Yahoo News poll. The poll also concludes that not all white folks are prejudiced. Stanford political scientist Paul Snyderman, who helped analyze the survey, said, and here's a quote, there are a lot fewer bigots than there were 50 years ago, but that doesn't mean there's only a few bigots. So what does this mean to you when you hear this sort of thing, Sean?
You know, I think this very thing is why a lot of African Americans would never allow themselves to believe that a black man could become president. And so these feelings are not a surprise. So as we move forward, I think, you know, we'll see more of these surveys and more of these things. But, you know, we've all been told all our lives, you have to, you know, run faster, you have to run harder, you have to study longer if you're black, if you're going after something that a white person has or is trying to give to you. And so I think the same thing is here in this case. Most of these studies show that it's about a 6-point difference for Barack Obama just on race. So his platform is going to have to make up that for that difference.
Were you surprised at all, Danielle, to hear about this?
Actually, no. I mean, when you think about how African-Americans have been traditionally portrayed in the media and art and music and just in everyday life and on television in America, I mean, who wouldn't have a negative perception of African-Americans, especially if you didn't know an African-American personally? And even some African-Americans themselves harbor some of these views. So this was not shocking, you know, at all. I mean, I guess it's good that that it's a little bit less than I thought, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be, you know, it was much, much, much worse when, you know, my parents' day. But no, I mean, when you deal with so much negative perception, imagery, when you turn on the local news and the only thing you ever see with black people usually involves a shooting of some kind, well, you're going to have that.
Let's follow that
perception.
Point up with this, because another blogger wrote, and this is a quote, "Calm down, it's just a poll. I imagine there's a poll out there somewhere that says 40% of black folks have a negative view of other black folks." What do you think of that?
Yeah.
I think it would probably have the same thing. You know, African Americans have a negative view of whites as well. I mean, you know, these polls are going to say this. And if you have an American who's 60 or over, more than likely they graduated from school, especially in the South, never having gone to a school with someone of the other race, all segregated schools. If it's someone 50 to 60, maybe they graduated from an integrated school, but probably attended segregated schools. So, you know, these issues and these feelings and these attitudes die hard. But I think the main thing is that this doesn't include everybody. And, you know, there are enough people who have differing opinions to probably offset that.
Well, you know, this is something I'm going to read to you that we hear a lot from some of our white listeners on News and Notes. And this blogger wrote, "Blacks vote overwhelmingly for a candidate who is black and no one cares. Whites decide not to vote for the black candidate and are called racist. I really can't wait for this election to be over." What about that? You know, race is a tricky thing to discuss, but this person is correct, aren't they, Danielle?
Well, I mean, it depends on how you look at it. I mean, a lot of Catholics voted for Kennedy in 1960. I mean, when you're an ethnic minority, a racial minority, a religious minority, you're going to be really excited about seeing one of your own in that position because you don't see them in that position ever. I mean, it just doesn't happen very often. So I feel like, you know, on one point, you know, maybe they have a valid point, but they're really looking at it from the wrong perspective. I mean, you're a majority-minority culture. If you're in the majority, you really just can't get agitated just because the smaller group that has a smaller representation gets really excited when one of their own finally gets in there.
Well, that's an interesting point of view. But when race is in the mix, Sean, I would think that that makes it difficult to avoid the label of having a double standard.
Well, the thing is, you know, Bill Clinton and Al Gore both enjoyed almost 90% African-American support in their presidential bids. And I bet Lynn Swann, when he was running for governor of Pennsylvania, would have loved to have had a 90% support of African-American voters. And he might be governor of Pennsylvania possibly. So, you know, you have to look at all the factors in this. And it's easy to say all black people are voting for Obama. But the truth of the matter is black people were more than willing to vote for Hillary Clinton at the beginning of the campaign. And as he put forth his agenda, more people went his way.
Are you thinking that people are going to vote for Obama more so, the black people I'm talking about now, more so because of his positions than his color?
Well, you know, the positions that make up, I mean, a lot of it. I mean, you look at his race with Alan Keyes in Illinois. I mean, I don't know many black people who would ever vote Alan Keyes for anything.
Well, that wasn't really much of a race. That really wasn't
That's
much
true.
Of a race.
That's true. It wasn't because he was, you know, a carpetbagger, that kind of
absolutely
one situation. But here in St. Louis, I mean, there are black Republicans. We have a columnist, Z. Dwight Billingsley, who often tries to run for office, but he runs into the same problem. Most blacks in St. Louis won't vote for him because of his views as a conservative and as a Republican. So,
all right, I tell you what, we're going to continue our conversation right after the break. Hopefully we'll be joined by our third blogger. So stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. We're back now with our bloggers roundtable. Joining us today are Sean Williams, who publishes the blog Dallas South, and Danielle Belton, who runs the blogs Black Snob and the Secret Council of American Negroes. Before we broke, we were talking about the election, but let's move on to another topic that it's kind of interesting when you look at the historical context, and I'm talking about none other than O.J. Simpson. In case you missed it in the news, O.J. is back in court, this time for reportedly storming into a Las Vegas hotel room last year with five other men to recover sports memorabilia that Simpson said belonged to him. Prosecutors say at least two men with Simpson had guns. He faces 12 charges, including kidnapping, armed robbery, and assault with a deadly weapon, and if found guilty, he could receive a life sentence. All right, so 1994 was the end of the trial, the first O.J. Simpson trial. But does anybody really care, Sean Williams, about O.J. Simpson's trial this time?
I think somebody cares. I mean, in a TMZ world that we're living in now, there's probably a market for this. There's probably a market for the blog that's following the trial. But, you know, as far as the mainstream media goes, I'm really hoping that they don't spend a whole lot of time on this. When the first trial came through, I mean, there were a lot of major networks. The first trial on this run came through, there are a lot of major networks leading with this. And so hopefully over the next few days, you know, I'm expecting that the mainstream media will probably take a back seat on this story. At least that's what I'm hoping.
I'm going to ask Danielle to hold on 1 second. Why do you hope that?
Well, you know, to me, this is not news right now. I mean, it could be news, but right now, you know, we don't even see that there was a bombing in Pakistan. That didn't even make the front page of the U.S. newspapers. And yet, you know, we are going to place O.J. Simpson on the front page and follow this trial. You know, I want to make sure that O.J. Simpson receives justice for sure. But, you know, there are so many other things going on in the world that I'm just hoping it doesn't receive too much attention.
Danielle, what are you saying?
I doubt it'll get much coverage. I mean, the election is so hot right now. The economy is a complete mess. We got two wars going on. I mean, OJ just really isn't relevant. And then there's the fact that there's no really glamorous angle with the trial this time. I mean, basically, it's OJ with a bunch of duplicitous characters. I mean, everyone in this whole thing seems to be crooked or criminal or have a shady past in some kind of way. I mean, if it weren't for the fact that he's O.J. Simpson, already has this infamous name attached to him, if he'd just been, you know, Joe Blow, you know, who barged into a room in Las Vegas with a bunch of other crooks to steal back his stuff that they stole, you know, I don't even know if they'd have this many charges going on. I don't even know if the police would care, because when criminals steal from other criminals, I mean, it's, you know.
So neither of you is feeling the O.J. trial.
I'm not feeling, but I think Danielle alluded to something that really is probably part of it, too, is that there is no interracial angle in this that we can see visually.
So it's not sexy. It's not sexy.
No, it's not.
That's part of what stimulated America the last time around.
It's old news, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, people were more thrilled about, you know, Paris Hilton getting dragged off to jail. I mean, that was, right. You know, it was like, oh, my God, it's Paris Hilton. And we all either hate her or we're fascinated by her. She's doing something interesting or crazy. Or it's Lindsay Lohan. She's crashed her car. It's like, you know, OJ.
Or she's
dating. He's back again.
She says who she's dating her girlfriend now. Okay. Well,
yeah.
Let's move on to another topic. This one is really interesting, I thought. I'd like to get your thoughts on it. Are you a guy who believes that a woman's place is in the home and that your job is to bring home the bacon while your wife watches the kids and cleans it? That's not a question for you. That's rhetorical, Sean.
A
new study suggests that your point of view may equal a fatter paycheck. A study published in the September issue of the Journal of Applied Psychology finds that men with quote-unquote traditional views about a woman's place in the world make more money than their peers who have a more egalitarian mindset. So, Danielle, does this come as a surprise to you?
It's not necessarily surprising, but I think things are more complicated than that. I mean, I was raised in a very traditional household. My dad was the primary earner in the household. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. But my dad was also, you know, held many feminist beliefs. He had nothing but daughters. He put us all through college and expected us all to go into, fields of work. So it's, you know, I can see why a man with a traditional view of a marriage and a woman's role would do better. So it's not surprising, but, you know, it's, I don't think it really gauges, though, the whole picture.
What do you say, Sean?
You know, Tony, I think this is a really fascinating study in that there are so many aspects of it that the study doesn't really address. I mean, you may have an attitude about the traditional role of women in the home, but yet your wife works. So if my wife works, but I have these views, then she takes off when the children are sick. She's the one that goes to school when there's a need for a meeting because I hold these traditional views. But that gives me an opportunity to make more money. And I think corporate America, you know, tends to like people who have those views. If you're a man going in and you're asking for time off to take off with your sick child, or if you want to ask for leave for a newborn, corporate America doesn't see that as a positive. So I think those are aspects of the study that would be great to see fleshed out.
One of the points that the authors of the study said was that what it showed is that it's not just a matter of disparity, income disparity between men and women, but that these traditional men make more money than both traditional women and egalitarian women, as they describe them, as well as egalitarian men. So if you want to make more money, if this study is correct, it was done over a 25-year period, you need to have these typical kinds of restrictive attitudes, I guess, would be one way to describe it. It seems to be working in the workplace, but I don't know that still falls into into form with the black community? Do you think it does?
Well, I think it's a complicated, a little bit different. I mean, traditionally in the black community, black women have always worked. I mean, my grandmother worked, her mother worked, my other grandmother, my dad's side worked because they had to. I mean, most of the men in my family, when you get into my uncles and great uncles, they were all day laborers or they were sharecroppers. You know, their wives cleaned houses, you know, and hospitals. I mean, so a woman working isn't really a new thing for the black community. Like, for, if anything, my mom being able to stay at home was like, you know, people thought that was strange. You know, people were often shocked that I had a stay-at-home mother. It was just like, your mother doesn't work. You know, they made all these weird false assumptions about it. But at the end of the day, it was seen as, you know, wow, you know, you're really lucky. Your mother really has the luxury of where they had a choice. Your family actually had a choice.
That's true. You know, and I think some black families have an unusual sort of setup, or maybe it's not that unusual. I had a stay-at-home mom, too. My dad made all the money, but my mom ran everything. So she was really in charge. He brought home the bacon, but she ran pretty much everything else. Was that the circumstance for you, Sean?
Both of my parents worked. But I would still say, you know, when you think about those traditional attitudes, you know, my mom was the one who picked me up from school if I was sick. My mom was the one who met with the teachers. And so, you know, I think when you really look at this study, you know, if a woman has the attitude that a man should be the one that works, but she still works herself, you know, her earning potential could potentially be less because of that. And so even though these women have the earning potential or belief that men should be making more, they're still making $14,000 less than the men who have those same beliefs that they did. So, you know, there's a lot of digging that can be done in this study. It's really fascinating.
Absolutely it is. One of our bloggers wrote, I'll share this with you before I say goodbye, I'll happily adopt a traditional viewpoint for another $1,000 a month. I wonder if HR has a form for that. We've been talking with Sean Williams, who publishes the blog Dallas South, and Danielle Belton, who runs the blogs Black Snob and The Secret Council of American Negroes. Thank you both.
Thank you.
The presidential election is now just weeks away, but thousands of ex-offenders across the country don't know they are eligible to vote in November, even with a past conviction. For more on voting rights, we are now joined by our regular contributor, Lynn Toler. She is the star of TV's Divorce Court. Judge Toler, nice to have you back.
It's good to be here, Tony.
You know, you've been getting pretty hot under the collar about this issue, I understand. Why is it such a concern for you?
It's a concern for me because it's a misunderstanding that a lot of ex-convicts have. If you have a felony, it has been in the past that often states do restrict or disenfranchise those who have a felony conviction. Those laws have changed over the years, and now in most states it's no longer the case, or there are means by which you can get your civil rights back. But a lot of people, a lot of ex-convicts or felons that I knew that ended up in my court system simply rested on the false notion that they did not have the ability to vote. And that ended, and that kept them from further embracing or engaging in the community, and kept them separate and apart and not where they needed to be.
Is it a situation where an ex-felon is entitled to have his or her voting rights restored, but the process by which those voting rights are restored is so cumbersome that they just either don't know about it or they don't go through it?
In some states, that is the truth, but that is in a minority of states. In most states, you get them back automatically, either after a certain period of years or after you're off any restriction like probation or parole. But indeed, in some states, it is so cumbersome, and they don't even know about it, how to go about it. And given the fact that they had been in prison and not negotiating socially and administratively out there, don't even know where to start.
Now, when someone... Is this something that you have spent time either counseling or explaining or teaching or instructing ex-felons how to go about doing this?
Yes, and it's because another judge friend of mine had a thing about it, and he used to tell me all the time, you make sure that everybody who comes before you, even if he has a felony, knows he can vote. And I also had a thing about my frequent flyers, people that I saw in my courtroom all the time, kind of living in a social circle that was so separate from my own. And I wanted to bring them into my own, get them invested and engaged in the community, which I think would make them less likely to reoffend. So I used to ask people who came before me when Bob Dole was running for president, who's Bob Dole? No one ever knew. And so I thought maybe that's just a personal problem he has. Maybe that's why he lost. And let me go to who's Al Gore when he was the vice president. No one knew that either. And I used to try to explain to them, to the extent that you are not invested in those people who are guiding the community, it will have an effect on you.
Are the people who come before you and who appear in court elsewhere in the country who have committed crimes of all sorts, are they people who would be likely to vote anyway? And once they are out of prison, would they be likely to pick that up?
And I think, unfortunately, the answer is no. I think the statistic shows us that those are the groups of people that would be least likely to vote or to be interested. And often I found that I'm an ex-felon was the excuse they gave me for not wanting to hear my "you need to vote, you need to vote, you need to vote" speech. So, I mean, it's not an answer to anything if we immediately re-enfranchise those people who were disenfranchised. I don't think you would see a significant increase in those people who ex-felons who would vote because they don't feel otherwise engaged in or a part of the community for a variety of reasons.
What is it that they seem to want the most when they do get out? If restoring their voting rights is on the list, but perhaps low on the list, if it's on their list at all, what would be at the top of that list?
I don't think it's on the list. I think what's on the list is just getting some money and enjoying their freedom. Money is hard to get because they've got a felony on their record. Employment is difficult. They usually don't have a great deal of education. So what they do is they go back into that environment that produced the criminal behavior beforehand, and they kind of have their own rules. And as long as they don't pop up again on the screen of the system, they kind of tool along. So they have a lot of them don't even have a driver's license and can't get one. So they have a lot of small, everyday hurdles to get over, and I don't even think voting makes the list.
Can you give us your opinion about whether or not you think felons should be allowed to vote while they are in prison, and are there any circumstances in any states where that is allowed?
There are two states that allow, I think it's Maine and Vermont, they allow inmates to vote. I don't like that. I don't like that for a couple of reasons. Number one, you have injured society to such an extent that we have taken away your basic freedom and liberty. If you've done that much injury to society, how can you get to lead that which you have injured? And two, if you're voting on a local level, if you do a crime in Chicago, you may go to prison anywhere in the state. So are you going to be able to control a local election in maybe a small town where the prison happens to be in? I find that problematic. I think it's important that once a felon is out, though, he be given every opportunity to be welcomed back, and so he would be less likely to reoffend.
You know, state disenfranchisement laws really impact men primarily. The Sentencing Project reports that some 1.4 million African-American men are affected. But what is the impact on women?
They're a little over. I mean, we always, you know, try to catch up with you guys. There are more and more women that are getting felonies. It's over, I think, almost 700,000 women who are dealing with that. But again, they have so many day-to-day issues of how to feed their kids, how to, you know, get a job, how to get a license and do all that. I really don't see voting does not come up high on their list of things to do.
Really briefly, Judge Toler, our time is up. There is an assumption, a myth perhaps, that those who are incarcerated, if they could vote, would vote Democratic, partly because so many of them are African-American. Is there any truth to that?
I have absolutely no idea.
That's an interesting position, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is an interesting position, and I really don't know. But I hope that's not the case, because I don't want everyone to think African-American, Democratic, and then we lose our power.
Interesting. Judge Tola, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was the TV Divorce Court Judge Lynn Toler. She is also the author of My Mother's Rules, A Practical Guide to Becoming an Emotional Genius. Judge Toler was speaking to us from member station KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona.